Hello, everybody, and welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series, and for anyone there who doesn't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I convened this series to invigorate the public dialogue that's taking place at the leading edge of consciousness and culture by asking one critical question and examining it from every possible perspective. How can higher consciousness play a meaningful and powerful role in helping human beings to rise to meet our current world crisis and challenges, to make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet? This is part of a series of remarkable conversations on this topic with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers, which you can access by registering at beyondawakeningseries.com. Today, I'm joined by Linda Graham. We're going to continue that discussion in a conversation we're titling Resilient Consciousness in Turbulent Times. I'll introduce Linda, and we'll spend then about an hour having a real conversation and an experiential exploration of this topic. Then I'll make some announcements, and then we'll spend about a half an hour taking your questions, so we'll finish up in about 90 minutes. Linda Graham is the author of the new book, Bouncing Back, Rewiring Your Brain for Maximum Resilience and Well-Being. She is a deep, wise, veteran psychotherapist, consultant, trainer, and meditation teacher in the San Francisco Bay Area, where she integrates the teachings of modern neuroscience, mindfulness practices, and contemporary Western psychology into her nationwide trainings and workshops and into her monthly e-newsletters, Healing and Awakening into Aliveness and Wholeness. Linda is especially talented at distilling simple, skillful guidance that helps people shift out of unproductive neurological routines, the patterns of response to life events that she sometimes has referred to as the neural swamp or neural cement. She deftly helps people to move into more flexible, adaptive patterns that lead to more authentic resilience and well-being. In her book and her trainings, Linda offers people dozens of experiential exercises that train what she identifies as the six C's of coping: calm, compassion, clarity, connection to resources, competence, and courage. She teaches people to learn to navigate the storms and struggles of life more quickly, more adaptively, more effectively, especially in our current turbulent times. Now, Linda is also a personal friend. And one of the things that I especially appreciate about her is the intelligence, grace, humility, depth, and poise with which she flows through the amazing ups and downs of life. We have gotten to know each other as members of a local group of folks who are interested in the connections between neuroscience, Dharma, and psychology. And in that group, the sessions that Linda has facilitated have been my very favorites because she's been able to lead us into authentic intimacy and depth with deceptive gentleness and skill in a way that really uses her deep knowledge of neuroscience to help us cover an awful lot of ground really quickly. So I wanted to share that experience with the Beyond Awakening community. So welcome, Linda. It's really a delight to have you on the program with me today.
It's a delight to be here, Terry.
So let's start at the very beginning. Here we have this whole focus on resilience. What do you mean by it? And, you know, how is the brain involved in developing or derailing our resilience?
So I define resilience as our capacity, which is innate in the brain, to face the challenges and crises of our lives with some flexibility and adaptability. So the title of the book, Bouncing Back, means that we can come back from adversity, back to our center, back to a sense of home. The brain is involved in that because the brain learns patterns of response from our earliest experiences in life and embeds those responses in our neural circuitry certainly our evolutionary legacy plays a role in that. We are hardwired to respond to certain kinds of experiences in certain ways. But the interactions that we have with the people around us not only embed patterns in the brain, but they develop and mature the structure of the brain that we most use for resilience, which is the prefrontal cortex. And in the book, I call that the CEO of resilience because it integrates the functioning of so many other structures of the brain. And when we have a mature prefrontal cortex, and that develops by about the time we're 25 years of age, then we're able to see what's happening and see our reactions to what's happening and decide if we want to choose a different way of responding. So the brain is essential in both wiring patterns in the first place. They become our automatic conditioned responses to life, and then helping us rewire or decondition those responses as we go forward.
Okay. And one of the key ideas that we've discussed on this series before in interviews with other people who share this focus, like Rick Hansen and Daniel Siegel, is the idea of using the mind, our own way of steering our attention and our participation in life, to change the brain, to change the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's certainly something you're very much working with. So there are ways of orienting our consciousness and have a so that we have a more resilient consciousness, and that we build the neurological structures of resilience. How do various states of consciousness contribute?
Well, we develop those states of consciousness most often in relationships with other people. So being in healthy, resonant relationships with people who are resilient absolutely plays a role in strengthening the structures of the brain that we need to be resilient. But also our mindfulness practice, which allows us to focus attention, notice and name it, which keeps the higher brain online, regulating the responses of the lower brain, and integrating the functioning of many different parts of the brain. So as we're perceiving and responding to our experience, we're actually trying to operate out of a more integrated whole brain kind of functioning. And that allows us to use different states of consciousness as we're responding to life events. We're all very familiar with the self-referential mode of processing, where we're focused on a task, we're focused on the details, we may be focused on our own history or narrative or identity or personality, and we become quite skillful in being able to perceive, analyze, and solve problems in that mode of processing. But there's also another state of consciousness, another way the brain has of processing information, which is a more defocused mode of processing. And we often experience this when we're in a form of daydream or reverie, or when we're in a meditative state that opens us up to a vaster, more spacious awareness of consciousness. And from there, the brain has a kind of mental play space that allows it to connect the dots in new ways. It's sort of the basis for revelation, epiphany, ahas, insights. And so it's also crucial in being able to understand and face the problems that we do today. Sometimes we need to focus and sometimes we need to defocus and come up with answers in a more roundabout way.
Yeah, this is an interesting point. We got into this quite a bit when I spoke with Daniels Brown, the mm-hmm. Buddhist meditation teacher who was kind of pointing out, he was recommending concentration and meditative practices that build the ACL, and that he was kind of basically arguing against a drifty kind of consciousness. But you seem to be saying there's a place for each of these states.
There's a place for each of these states of consciousness, and part of our skill is knowing which state to use when to approach a problem in what particular way. It's true that concentration practice focuses the mind and strengthens all of the structures of the brain that we need to be resilient. It's just that the defocusing network is a different way of being with the experience or being with the problem. And when people say, oh, all of a sudden I thought of something out of the blue, it comes out of that mode of processing. So it's more the realm of using imagination or reverie to be able to play with our experience rather than focusing on it so exactly.
Ah, that you may really create openings for the new and for creativity and imagination and what's emergent rather than purposively and strategically focusing our attention to create a known outcome. Is that what you mean?
Exactly. That's exactly what I mean.
Okay. Well, then that's very important.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we approach our problems at our own peril if we're not skillful and receptive to both modes of processing.
Mm-hmm. So it's really more about flexibility and choice than it is about valuing one over another.
Right, and resilience is all about flexibility. The researchers have found that resilience is not having the answer or knowing the rules or being able to respond the same way all the time to the same situation. It's about being able to change our responses and be flexible. That's what makes us resilient. And the prefrontal cortex that I mentioned earlier is the structure that we use for response flexibility. It's what allows us to perceive our experience and shift our response to it. So anything that we can do, as I mentioned, healthy relationships, mindfulness practice, that strengthens the functioning of the prefrontal cortex, strengthens the functioning of the brain so that we can be more resilient. I also think it's the prefrontal cortex that allows us to toggle back and forth between these different states of consciousness or different modes of processing experience. So a strong, mature prefrontal cortex is what allows us to daydream and use our imagination without getting too drifty and lost. And it's what allows us to concentrate and focus and pay attention to details without getting too rigid. And so the prefrontal cortex is an integration of those two.
Now, all this emphasis on the prefrontal cortex, you know, I by no means consider myself a brain expert, but I, you know enough to know that it's really the uniquely human part of our brain, and it's where we do a lot of our conceptual, I mean, a lot of things go on in the prefrontal cortex. It's a large and important, you know, dimension of the brain, and it, there are a lot of things that go on in the prefrontal cortex that are not terribly skillful uses of our hardware, software. So just the fact of emphasizing it is certainly not sufficient. When you say a strong and mature one, you're distinguishing it from all kinds of fixed ways of being maybe stuck in aspects of prefrontal cortical activity that are less resourceful. How would you distinguish them?
Well, I'm taking my notes on the prefrontal cortex from Daniel Siegel, who identified many of the functions of the prefrontal cortex that we need for resilience. It regulates the nervous system. So it regulates our revving up into fight, flight, freeze, or our collapsing into too much numbing out or shutting down. The prefrontal cortex regulates that. It regulates the flow of emotions in the brain so that when we get these surges of sensation in our body that are important signals of how we're to respond to something, the prefrontal cortex is what allows us to manage that flow so that we're not hijacked or flooded by it. It's what quells the fear response in the amygdala, in the lower brain. So that's very important to be able to be resilient and come out of an amygdala hijack back into a baseline equilibrium where we can think clearly. It's what allows us to attune to our own experience and that of other people, and empathize with our own experience and that of other people to be able to make sense of the story. It's what allows for insight and awareness and for response flexibility. So when we begin to notice that we're operating out of our implicit, automatic, reflexive patterns, you know, we drive to work the same way, we respond to the doorbell ringing the same way, or someone irritating us on the phone in the same way. When we can begin to notice the automaticity of our responses, which is about how we operate 80% of the time, And then we can begin to change them with the awareness, the monitoring, the modifying. We can begin to change them. And so that's a good use of the prefrontal cortex.
Yeah. And when I imagine myself using my prefrontal cortex with what I know about neuroscience, I imagine myself simply having the witnessing ability to observe what's happening and the choice-making ability to notice my options and to choose intelligently and sensitively how I'm going to relate to experience. Is that what you're meaning mainly to indicate in terms of I'm trying to take it into something more subjective?
Well, absolutely. The witnessing is essential, and the sense of choice making is essential. The sense that we have, we can shift our perspectives, we have options, we can discern the options, we can discern a wise choice. One of the things that I think is important coming out of modern neuroscience, and especially someone like Richard Davidson, who has one of the leading neuroimaging labs in the country, but he's also very, very interested in consciousness and mindfulness and has done some of the seminal studies about how mindfulness rewires the brain. He's saying that once we know that the brain has neuroplasticity, it is able to grow new neurons and grow new connections among those neurons and even change its own structures lifelong. Once we know that, and once we know the kinds of experiences that will most efficiently, safely, effectively help the brain rewire itself, we not only have a choice, which we do, we have a choice, but we have a responsibility to begin to learn how to rewire our brain to be the most effective, efficient, and the most resilient. So I think that's one of the pieces that I'm trying to emphasize in the book Bouncing Back, that once we know we have choices and we have the capacity to rewire the automatic responses we've gone through our lives with, we have a responsibility to learn how to and to begin to. And I think that's part of what lends us a resilient consciousness in turbulent times. We have not only a choice, we have a responsibility to show up and learn how to do that.
Well, yeah, I in previous conversations I've pointed out to you that asking the question I ask on this series when we look at this whole matter of reestablishing resilience, I certainly want to be more personally resilient and more personally calm and equanimous in the way I go through the flow of my day, but I don't want to adopt an attitude toward experience that makes personal calm and equanimity the ultimate, final, and only goal. I don't want to very calmly rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic while we go into a pretty harrowing world crisis. You know, it feels like the sense of personal responsibility and engagement ought to be heightened, not necessarily the sense of anxiety, but the sense of engagement. So, when you look at the essence of resilience, how does that work for individuals, and then how does that work for us in our relations with each other in terms of creating coherence and cooperation and an ability maybe for us to communicate in the ways we need to in order to work together more positively in these times?
So my book focuses a lot on recovering resilience in the personal sense, and I'm trying to teach exercises that help people rewire their brain from the bottom up so that they develop more resilient brain functioning, and then that becomes the platform for a lot of what is offered in self-help or personal transformation worlds. But the last chapter of the book talks about moving beyond the resilient personal self to that sense of engagement and being an agent for social change in the world. And resilience is what allows us to do that, being able to be resilient, shift perspectives, cope adaptively and flexibly is the platform for broader horizons, the larger view, bigger perspectives. It's a platform for more collaboration and cooperation and interconnection among people, more tolerance and diversity among people. And it's the opening into altruism and into a larger sense of compassion and into a larger sense of understanding and forgiveness. Mm. So resilience is the platform for many of the qualities that we need if we want to engage with the world in a wise way.
Mm-hmm. And in a way, the degree of the interruptions, the volume of relational exchanges, of emails, of texts, of phone calls, of inputs of various kinds, the kinds of supernormal stimuli, the things that seem like exaggerated allurements or threats or temptations or suggestions that we ought to mobilize in one way or another for, to buy things, the communications of lack. All of these things that we're bombarded with, all of them tend to numb and degrade our resilience. So these really are survival skills just for showing up. And in a way, I find myself feeling that I want to maybe begin to invite you to share the skill sets and maybe some of the exercises, the experiential dimensions of what I know we want to get into, rather than only talk about it in these objective terms that, are interesting and important to frame the conversation, but maybe don't really give us the tools for surviving this crazy world.
So that's where I was hoping this part would go. If I begin to talk about the first C of coping, which is calm, and that's actually a fairly big topic. As we learn about the nervous system and learn that our automatic survival responses when we're faced with a crisis or when we're faced with overwhelm will be to either rev up into a kind of fight, flight, freeze response or to shut down in a numbing out, collapsing response. And in between the two is what is called the window of tolerance. It's our baseline equilibrium. It's a natural state in the body where we can be both calm and relaxed and engaged and alert. And from that state, which I think is synonymous with equanimity in a spiritual practice, when we can be in that equanimous, calm, relaxed, engaged, alert state, which is the natural state of equilibrium in our body, then we're able to activate, to rev up, but without fear, without a survival response. We can move into exploration, play, creativity, productivity, changing the world as we know it. When we're able to be in that state, we can calm down without going into withdrawal or avoidance or shutdown or collapse. We can be calm and meditate. We can make love. We can take a nap on the beach so that we're able to be in our nervous system in a way that allows us to actually be resilient. One of the techniques that I teach to do that instantly is what I call hand on the heart. And it's very, very simple, and I can just walk through it, but also talk about the neuroscience just briefly about why it works. When you put your own hand on your own heart, the warm touch of your own hand on your own heart begins to activate the release of oxytocin, which is the natural hormone in the brain. It's the hormone of safety and trust. It's the hormone of bonding and connection. So when you begin to release oxytocin, it's the brain's direct and immediate antidote to the stress hormone cortisol. Then when you breathe deeply into your heart center, you're activating the parasympathetic branch of your nervous system, the calming down branch, so that you're actually restoring some more equilibrium in your body. If you breathe in a sense of positive emotions into the heart center, like gratitude, kindness, compassion, joy, love, awe, delight, then you're restoring the heart rate variability to its natural coherent rhythm. Then the next step of the exercise, because all of that can be done in just a few seconds, is to take a moment to remember a moment, one moment, when you felt safe and loved and cherished by someone. And that could be a partner or a child, but it could also be a friend, a teacher, a spiritual figure, a pet. And when you evoke in your own memory that sense of being safe, loved, and cherished, then the oxytocin can start flowing through your entire body, and you get this sense of warmth and glow and safety and trust that everything is okay or everything is going to be okay. And that technique, the hand on the heart, can calm down a panic attack in less than a minute. So when I teach people, my clients or people in my workshops, to do hand on the heart many times a day, it becomes the new automatic response to a situation that's starting to feel slightly stressful or startling or upsetting. And we just practice calming down our nervous system, coming back into equilibrium and equanimity over and over and over, so that that becomes the natural thing that we do in the face of anything.
Aren't we also able from that place to manifest intensity as well? It isn't only about a certain manner always being idealized, is it?
When we can come into that equilibrium, we can be both calm, but we can also be very actively, productively engaged in the world with clear thinking. Our mind is not clouded by any fear or projection. And so that state of equilibrium becomes the basis of all effective action.
Yay.
Yay.
Yeah. Great. That really resonates. Well, you know, you really have worked out a whole sequence here with calm, this, you know, the six C's. I'd like to invite you to, you know, keep going through, and as you know, at points I might ask a question or you know, make a distinction like I just did, but I'd love to continue this experiential journey. I think it's rich and valuable.
So one of the more effective ways we have of coming back into calm is to be able to activate a sense of self-compassion. And, of course, compassion for everyone and for the world at large is essential. But often we don't know how important it is to activate self-compassion, to have a moment of mindfully noticing, ouch, this hurts. This is a moment of suffering. And before we move to fix it or push it away or move on, we just take a moment to say, what would be comforting? What would be caring? What would be helpful to me in this moment right now before I go on? Kristen Neff calls this putting our own oxygen mask on first before we try to help other people in the world. And what self-compassion does is it also activates the caregiving system, it activates the oxytocin, but it helps us also experience what's called a left shift in the brain. So the neuroscientists have found that people who practice compassion actively over much time activate more neural firing in the left hemisphere in the brain than in the right. And the reason that that's important is that the right hemisphere carries forward the negativity bias of the lower brain. It carries forward our tendency to withdraw or avoid. The left hemisphere develops slightly later than the right hemisphere, so it's not as connected to the lower brain. And it tends to have more of an approach stance toward experience. So when we can cultivate a practice like self-compassion, and there are others that work as well, gratitude, generosity, we shift the functioning of the brain to the left. We are more likely to stay open to our experience, to perceive it accurately, and to be able to decide how to respond to it. So when we're doing a self-compassion practice, which could be simply a hand on the heart or a hug, or we get a pat on the back from someone, we just take a moment to care about ourself as the being that is experiencing the experience before we move on to change the experience. If you have a question before I go on, please.
No, go right ahead. Okay. I think this is good.
So that then creates a platform for clarity. And, of course, we use a mindfulness practice to increase our clarity. What's important here as in any mindfulness practice, is to be able to notice and name our experience. When we name our experience, we're keeping the higher brain online, which allows us to regulate the lower brain and not go into such a fear response. When we begin to notice our cascades of emotions, our patterns of thought, and begin to see that they come and go, which is what happens in a mindfulness practice. I'm not feeling the same thing right now that I was 10 minutes ago or an hour ago or last week. And we see that our experience comes and goes. That allows us to relax the grip on our self-identity, our perception of things, and shift into more different perspectives, to more options. So when we're being mindful, we're not just noticing what's happening in the moment and our reaction to what's happening in the moment. We're noticing that the moments change moment by moment, and we begin to move into that kind of flexibility that is required for resilience. And so the mindfulness allows us to see and discern the options and choose more wisely. That can lead to us connecting to resources, and whether that's people as resources, people as a refuge where we can regroup and pull ourselves together, or as a resource, role models showing us how things are done, giving us examples of resilience. Places can act as a refuge and a resource where we go to calm down our nervous system, to resettle our molecules, as my friend Phyllis says, and regroup and center and come back. And practices like meditation, like yoga, that allow us to get more clarity and strength to persevere. One of the most important resources that we can cultivate is positive emotions. There's been so much study done now on the role of positive emotions in moving us out of the negativity bias and into a more resourced place where we're able to see options, trust people, communicate with people, so that one of the outcomes of cultivating positive emotion is resilience. It's not that we are resilient and therefore we feel happy. It's when we cultivate generosity, gratitude, kindness, compassion, joy, those emotions over time make us more resilient, and they affect our health. We're less vulnerable to illness like stroke, diabetes, or heart disease. We have less stress response. People who cultivate positive emotions tend to live on average 7 to 9 years longer. We have more social connections. We have more of a sense of purpose and fulfillment and meaning in life. And so by taking the time to notice a moment of gratitude or notice a moment of kindness, whether we're offering it or receiving it, helps us become more resilient, more creative, more flourishing in our lives. And that gives us the strength then to reach out and help other people.
You know, Linda, it's interesting as first of all, I really admire the way that you've laid this all out in a very, very user-friendly way. I mean, I think someone can understand probably from the book as well, and certainly from these descriptions, you know, very clear things. Some of which, you know, as I reflect, you know, I've been a meditator and a spiritual practitioner for most of my life, you know, 40 years or more. And in that time, some of these things you're talking about have become second nature to me. And others, you know, haven't, and they're the kinds of things that I'm practicing with now, the kind of things I have to remember in order to really navigate well.
Mm-hmm.
And the thrust of the kind of discussion I've been pursuing on this series that, you know, people who listen regularly are familiar with is a kind of passionate inquiry. Like, I take very seriously the world crisis, and taking it seriously, I'm very aware that a playful and lighthearted way of living is the only way I'm going to be a resourceful contributor to something better. So it's not about getting grim and sober. But I definitely try to, part of what I get from many spiritual traditions, including some of the ideas that you're bringing forward now, is a kind of skillful means, like a user's manual for us people with brains about how to self-manage this tool that we have. And I love that, but that's a very kind of cool stance. It's kind of like, well, let's help this thing function better. And of course, then there are the larger realities that we're functioning in relation to that I always care to take seriously and to be passionate and alive in relation to. Mm-hmm. So I want to use my neurology better, but I want to use my neurology better in order to be not removed from life in this meta management of my neurological system. I want to be managing my neurological system so that it doesn't take me out of context, so that I can really show up and be more fully alive and engaged and humorous and playful and passionate and wild and crazy and fun and happening, you know,
mm-hmm.
not somehow muted and above it all in some sort of meditative calm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're reminding me of what our mutual friend, Andy Dreitzer, has said in the Neurodharma Group, that I take all things seriously and I hold them all lightly. And so we're talking about some kind of balance of absolutely showing up and facing what's going on in our world and holding it all lightly enough that we're not overwhelmed, we're not discouraged, we're not in despair. We're able to see what we need to do going forward. It's sort of the traditional teachings, in a way, about wise effort, of how do you let go of the unwholesome and cultivate the wholesome so that you're really moving toward the liberation of yourself and of all beings. So I think what you're saying leads, in a way, to the last two C's on this trajectory, which are competence and courage, because that's where we're beginning to engage with the world more, again, in ways that feel competent and that we have the courage to persevere.
Yeah. Well, competence in a way that is both, competently fully human and,
Competent in the sense that I have a belief in my own efficacy, in my own capacity to make things different. And for all that we practice accepting things as they are and being with things as they are, there is a sense of, I know that I can act in ways that will get a response, that will create a change. And we need to know that about ourselves, to have faith in what we're doing, and then to have the courage to, you know, one of the exercises I teach in the book is to do one scary thing a day. And when you do one scary thing a day, you're training your brain to get across the threshold, which we all have as human beings, when we're faced with something new. It doesn't even have to be risky. We're just faced with something new. Uh-oh, I've never seen this before. I don't know if I should be doing this. And we have to train the brain to get across that threshold by taking action, by doing something. And so when we do one scary thing a day, one of the things that I love about neuroscience is to rewire the brain. It doesn't matter how big the effort is. It doesn't have to be big, intense, and dramatic. It just has to be consistent and persistent. So we do something little, but we do it often. And that's how the brain rewires. It rewires more if we do something for 5 minutes every day than if we do it for an hour on the weekend. So it's doing something small, but doing it steadily, which is what allows the brain to rewire. That's also what allows us to be agents of change in the world, to do whatever we're doing often, steadily, persevering. That's how we'll be able to create the change. And so doing one scary thing a day trains our brain to be able to do that, to be able to persevere.
Yeah. Well, I love that. I love that friendliness toward scary experience. I find that my my life delivers me more than one a day.
Right.
If I could limit it to one a day.
Uh-huh.
But no, I think you kind of mean choosing maybe something that's a stretch in a more deliberate way, which seems like a really great practice. And I love, love, love what you've just said about the beauty and potency and centrality of consistency. I know that this is central to aspects of the way I teach meditation in my course. I'll announce something about something I'm doing there at the break. And one of the key principles that I pay attention to is bringing that free consciousness that we arrive at in our deepest meditation into life in random moments throughout the day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's those brief moments repeated many times throughout our lives that seem to really help that meditative clarity bleed through and inform the way that we participate in our actual daily experience. And
mm-hmm.
it seems to me that's, you know, entirely consistent with what you're pointing out there.
Mm-hmm. And if our practice, part of our practice is, as we go throughout the day, checking in, how am I doing now? It's just being mindful and reflective. Am I in a state of calm? Is there any suffering here? Is there any criticism here? Is there any fear here? And bringing that to awareness so that we can, as you say, meta-manage back into that state of equilibrium so that we can continue going forward in a resilient way. So as we check in many times a day, we're checking in on our resilience and our resilient consciousness many times a day and bringing it back to center if we need to.
Yeah, nice. So when you confront the fact that we're living in a world, in a time in which there's tremendous, you know, we are the most privileged, lucky people who've ever lived. We have incredible wealth and comfort and safety, at least in the United States and in Western Europe and Japan and various other countries that are, you know, relatively stable, tremendous levels of affluence, incredible access to information, incredible access to mobility, even travel, and yet we're in a time of global warming, mass extinction of many species, destabilization of most human institutions, whether it's education or healthcare or government or, you know, you name it. Everything is in crisis at once. We all feel a sense of responsibility for it. We have a real responsibility. And calming ourselves at the first level usually involves kind of just getting back to the body and the immediacy of our experience where we're definitely okay. But I certainly do see people very often, even very conscious people, kind of trying to tune out those bigger threats and those bigger challenges. And it always concerns me. You know, I know that I want us to have that resilience so that we can become the source of the strength of the larger human system, making the adaptive responses that are called for in this very critical time that we're living in, and we're here for a reason. How does that all register for you, and how are you, you know, what can you offer our listeners in terms of that?
Well, I think one of the things that neuroscience has contributed is a sense, given our genes, given our conditioning, given the culture and societies that we grow up in, there's a lot about our patterns that are not our fault. You know, we're conditioned and we're hardwired in certain ways. But at the same time, once we know how the brain works, once we know how to create change in the brain, it is our responsibility. And I think that extends from the micro level to the macro level. One of Lou Cozzolino's phrases is from neurons to neighborhoods. And the same agents of change seem to be applying at all those levels. If I take responsibility for my automatic reactions to things and begin to cultivate and choose wiser, more resilient patterns, that just isn't in my individual brain. That begins to extend to all the people and relationships I have, and not doing things in an automatic way, but choosing how I'm relating, and then how I relate to the larger issues, to the institutions of our times. It's not my fault but it is my responsibility. And when we work on resilience, that sort of becomes the mantra. It's not my fault, but it is my responsibility. And that's the fulcrum of how we can just, as we change our brains and change our lives, we just keep changing everything we're involved in, including our societies and our planet.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I love that. Does this work in order to enrich our resilience, create an arc of growth? Like, do you see people beginning, like maybe if somebody's really in an anxious and dysregulated state when they begin, the first stages would be to reestablish a better coping and maybe more successful outcomes and a certain baseline of well-being. But then as we continue to build resilience, is there, you know, how can you describe the arc of growth in this work of understanding our neurology and becoming more and more resilient, you know, as that takes us into more and more positive territory?
Well, one of the things that I did try to address in the book is when we are trying to learn how to meta-manage a dysregulated self, so we have a sense of being in anxiety or in depression or in anger. And as we learn the better coping, as we become more resilient, our sense of self changes. And we have a sense of ourself as larger and wiser. And if we keep exploring that sense of self, eventually we lose our grip on the sense of personal self and expand into more essential true nature. And when people begin in a meditation experience or in a relational experience to get a sense of their own true nature or divine nature or essence or whatever we begin to call it, then that leads us to a sense of, as Walt Whitman said, oh, I'm larger than I thought. I didn't know I held so much goodness. And that goodness then, that claiming our goodness, so I still have moments of anxiety or anger or grief, but fundamentally I'm aware, I'm compassionate, I can hold all those human experiences in my own sense of larger goodness. That has to tap us into a sense of the essential goodness of every human being on the planet, no matter what the conditioning, no matter what the circumstances. Eventually we begin to see and experience for ourselves that essential goodness of all of us and the common humanity of all of us. When we get to that kind of realization or truth, in a way, there's no going back. There's no going back to the contraction of the smaller personal self. It just doesn't make sense anymore. And so we continue to do our practices to stay open, to stay expanded, to stay skillful, so that we're resilient not only for our own behalf, but on behalf of everyone that we know is just like us.
Yeah. And that arrives us in a pretty profound place. And, you know, it seems like there's an existential confrontation at a certain level. Like, as I become more, as my own well-being is more and more the ground I'm resting on, then a sense of responsibility, a sense of possibility, especially in the context of our dizzyingly rapid cultural evolution, you know, seems to well up.
And I think if there is a trajectory, if there is an arc here, I love what you just said about our own well-being and resting there allows us to move into a sense of responsibility and possibility, and I think even joy. That there's just a sense of joy at feeling so connected to so much of life, to all of life. And then we care deeply. We care deeply and passionately. We may each choose our own angle, our own path, develop depending on our talents and our preconditioning. And so someone's going to be a musician and someone's going to be an engineer and someone's going to be a physician and someone's going to just clean the toilets with a lot of grace, you know. But we each, even when we all have our own path, we're simply manifesting consciousness realizing itself or life living itself. And there's tremendous power in knowing that we're doing that.
Beautiful. Well, Linda, as you kind of reflect on the conversation we've had so far, are there some points that you were hoping to make in the midst of this conversation that we've kind of steered away from that might be good to circle back and include?
The only thing that I would say now is that when people do understand how their own brains work, and when they begin to get a sense of competence at knowing how their brain works and knowing how to change that, and they grab onto the self-directed neuroplasticity, I can make choices, I can choose to train my brain in this direction or that direction, it often is a tremendous relief and a liberation from fear. I guess that's the turning point that I've seen so often in my clients and in people in my trainings, that there's just a turning of the arc from, I don't know if I can do this, I'm so small, to, wait a minute, of course I can do this, I'm learning how to do this, look at me. And then there just becomes more willingness to reach farther and to try for more, because it seems possible. And I think that sense of knowing how our brains work and knowing what to do with it opens up not just the responsibility, but the possibility.
Mm.
And people become really gung-ho about improving themselves and changing the world.
You know, I know you're such an artist in terms of creating experiential exercises. You know, I think I'd like to, you know, respond to that really beautiful expression of your care and what inspires you by asking you if there is an exercise that you can maybe guide us all in right now that would kind of go to the heart of that whole yes, I can kind of point that you just articulated so well.
Well, I can try. I'll do this one because I've seen it also have, it's very simple and has a lot of power with people. And I learned it originally from Natalie Rogers, who is Carl Rogers' daughter and an experiential psychotherapist. So we begin, it's a body-based exercise, and a person would do it in silence, not really paying attention to other people in the room. But you begin by letting your body embody a posture that expresses an emotion or a state of mind, a mood that is problematic. And you don't have to think about it a lot. You just let your body do whatever it's going to do. And it may be that it curls up in a ball. Or, I mean, just letting the body embody this smaller, more contracted state. And then you stay in that state, not necessarily on the air right now, but you stay in that state for 45 seconds so that you really get a felt sense in your body of what that feels like. Then, without thinking, without naming, you just simply let your body lead you into the opposite posture. And very often for people, this might be standing tall or standing more straight, arms up in the air in victory or whatever. And you simply embody that posture for 45 seconds. Then you go back to the first posture, the one that's more problematic, for 20 seconds. And then you return to the second opposite posture, the more expansive posture, for 20 seconds. Then you let your body come back into a posture that is somewhere in the middle. And people can be very surprised by what they experience in this exercise. Very often people will experience something that feels more empowering or more steady or more stable or firm. But one of the first times I ever did this with a client, he was working on depression, and to his surprise, the opposite posture, the opposite wasn't necessarily happiness or joy, it was reverence. And so we're learning to listen to the body, the body's wisdom, about what we need to do that is the opposite of what has been afflictive or contracting. And when people are trying to become more resilient, it's powerful to experience in the body that by changing the stance, they can feel more resilient. And people can do that before they walk into a meeting or before they have to do something that's difficult or challenging, is just to embody a posture that gives them that sense of strength or courage. And that affects the brain and the mind.
That's really cool. That's
mm-hmm.
a very that I love that exercise too.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Linda. That really resonates for me.
Great.
Well, it's time for us to make some announcements. First of all, please, you're invited to ask questions. So press star 2 on your telephone keypad if you'd like to ask a question live, or go ahead and type in a question for Linda or for me in the instant teleseminar window if you're listening online through your computer or through your iPhone, for that matter, for any online device. Now, the first thing I'd like to do is to make sure you know how to find out more about Linda and her work. The book that really spells out everything we've been talking about and experiencing is Bouncing Back: Rewiring Your Brain for Maximum Resilience and Well-Being, which has already sold out its first printing and is really doing well. It's available at your local bookstore or online. It has been enthusiastically endorsed by most of the other well-known authors at the crossroads of neuroscience and psychology and contemplative practices, including Jack Kornfield, Rick Hansen, Daniel Siegel, Tara Brach, Sylvia Boorstein, Shauna Shapiro, and many others. And it includes more than 80 experiential exercises to help you rewire your brain for more resilience, safety, efficiency, and effectiveness. So many of the exercises are archived on Linda's own website, and I want to give you the URL for that. It's just Linda Graham, run together, LindaGraham, MFT, LindaGraham-MFT.net, where you'll also find archives of her monthly e-newsletter, which is really excellent, Healing and Awakening into Aliveness and Wholeness. So that's LindaGraham-MFT.net. Additionally, I want to tell you a little bit about my work. I have mentioned many times my online course, Integral Spiritual Practice, which was recently released digitally for the first time. It's an 8-session course that takes you through a step-by-step process that bridges you from being a seeker to being a real practitioner in a way that's truly uncommon, being really grounded in the most radical and embodied wisdom of the world's most highly awakened spiritual realizations, but not a hyper-masculine path of seeking. It's a deeply heart-centered, self-compassionate, and humane path. It still generates the yogic fire necessary for transformation, and not just on the meditation cushion, but in life. It's based on the principle that all life is yoga, and it gives you that in a highly efficient, simple, doable form, flexible, and not too time-demanding. A whole worldwide sangha is forming around it, and it's really inspirational for me to see the life transformations and the practical projects that are coming forth as people come alive in the mystery and activate their mission. It's a truly wonderful and an amazing value. It's available for only $297 at terrypattencourse.com, just terrypattencourse.com. But today, I want to tell you about something special. Over the last half of this year, for 6 months, from early July until early January, I'm going to personally guide just a small group of people through my course in a more deeply individualized way. I'm inviting a small circle of 8 to 12 people. And so if you haven't taken my course, or really even if you have, but if you want an opportunity to do it in a way that really builds for you a circle of intimate spiritual friends, other people who will be waking up and taking responsibility and transforming with you, this is maybe for you. So if you're interested, just go to my regular website. Instead of terrypattencourse.com, it's terrypatten.com. just click when you get there, contact, and type on the subject line, personal work, and we'll send you more information about that program, terrypatton.com, and then send an email with personal work in the subject line. Finally, please stay on the line. At the very end of this call, I'll tell you about my next guest on the program, Professor Terrence Deacon, who I'm very excited to be interviewing. So let's see if we have some questions. And yes, we do. Claudette Gregg in Mill Valley asks you to speak to how we can access the courage aspect of this in more depth, and more about understanding our inner resources, maybe in the deeper way. She's enthusiastic about this topic of resilience and offers thanks.
So I have found that courage tends to come when we've experienced ourselves being competent at something. And so that's why I put it in the order that I did. When we have a sense of mastery about anything, and it doesn't have to be something big, it's just that we know how to boil our eggs in the morning, that begins to transfer to, well, I did that well, I can do the next thing well. And as we begin to develop that sense of competence over time, it supports the courage. I haven't done this before, it's a little scary, but I've done other things before that were scary, so I can try this too. So it's more, what happens in the courage system is we can find a sense of support and resourcing through the oxytocin system, through people believing in us and encouraging us, and that's a very, very important way of doing it. But we can also use the dopamine system, which is the basic neurotransmitter of pleasure and reward. And what happens in the nervous system is if things are going along as we expect them to, dopamine operates on an expectation system. So if things are going along as we expect them to, the dopamine is running and we have that sense of satisfaction, pleasure, and reward. If we see something new and we go, uh-oh, this is not what I expected, I've not seen this before, the dopamine stops. And we can get a sense of anxiety in our nervous system. And in order to get the dopamine running again, we need to see ourselves taking an action, however small, and succeeding at it, and that gets the dopamine going again. When people now teach how to create a new habit or how to change a habit, it's very important. You have the cue, you have the reminder, you have the whole routine, the new habit that you're trying to cultivate, and then you have the reward, you get the dopamine going. But they also suggest just get the first 30 seconds of that new habit. You don't have to do the whole routine. Just do the first 30 seconds of it, and that gets your brain going in the dopamine circuit again. You already have the reward of even beginning before you complete the whole sequence. So to do something small, manageable, I did it, and get the dopamine going again is how we continue to support our courage. We have that sense of success, accomplishment, reward. I hope that's helpful.
What a useful little tip that is. Very cool.
Mm-hmm.
I like that a lot. Let's hear from a live caller. Someone calling from a phone that shows up as being in Vancouver, B.C. under the listing Lloyd Kosky. You're on the air. Please introduce yourself.
Hello, it's not Lloyd. It's Felicia, though.
Welcome.
Hi. This is the first time I ever joined you. I've always wanted to. It's my first time, and I'm so happy. So my question is about the feeling of joy. And what I've been noticing is that I don't consider joy an emotion. I consider it a pure essence, like love or like peace. I find it's most difficult for me to maintain joy, that it's usually I am experiencing it sometime larger than I can handle. What do you have to say about that?
Mm-hmm. So one of the trainings I've had over the last many years is James Barra's Awakening Joy course. And in that sense, I agree with you that joy is not simply an emotion. It is more of a state of being or a state of consciousness. And there are many, many practices that help us cultivate that sense of joy, a sense of gratitude, a sense of connection with other people, a sense of competence at dealing with suffering and finding joy in the midst of it, being able to be mindful and noticing our experiences and taking them in when they lean in the direction of joy, having an intention to cultivate it. But as we begin to experience more and more joy, it does tend to crack us open beyond our personal sense of self or our personal sense of identity up until that time. It tends to keep leading us beyond the personal self. That can be a pleasant experience. It can be a little frightening if we're not used to it, if we're not familiar with it. So one of the best ways, I think, to support that experience of joy is being able to hang out with other people who also know that realm, who know what it's like to be joyful and to feel steady in it. One of the things that I would say now that I didn't say before is that because the brain is a social organ, the brain develops always the best initially only in interacting with other human brains. So because the brain is a social organ, it rewires the best when we're in interaction with other people. And if we're in interaction with other people who are joyful, our brain is going to learn even better how to be in that state and sustain that state without going into any kind of contraction. Or sometimes, okay, one thing that happens fairly commonly for people is that a sense of joy or happiness can evoke a sense of grief or sadness. I'm happy now, but oh, all those years when I didn't know about this, and it can evoke that sense of grief. So it's really important, I think, to be held in a community, if you will, of people who know about joy and can continue holding us as we explore the various ramifications of it so that we don't shut down in the face of that expansive state of being.
Thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much for calling.
You're welcome.
Okay, we'll take another one of the typed-in questions. We have quite a few of those. One person was having a little trouble getting your website, and I want to make sure we have that really clear. It's lindagram-mft.
Not hyphen dot, it's just hyphen MFT.
Right, -mft.net.
Right.
Mary Frank and Tom, right. So,
But also I do believe if you simply Google Linda Graham MFT, the website will come up.
Okay, good. All right. We have another series of questions about aging, how this relates to the sobering experience of aging and loss of function or limits, loss of friends, you know, all the things that go with that.
So I'm going to refer to two of my mentors in the field of aging. One is Luke Cozzolino, who wrote a book on sort of the neuroscience of healthy aging. And one of the most important things is to stay connected with people. That very often as we age, we lose some of that fast, sharp capacity we have when we're younger to memorize a lot of things or solve a lot of problems. But as we get older, the capacity to relate to other people and be the wise elders of our tribe, in fact, increases. And interaction with other people primes the brain to be neuroplastic. When we are isolated or alone is when the neurons begin to shut down and we begin to lose our functioning. So staying involved with people is one of the best ways we have of keeping our brain healthy as we age. Another way, which is really extraordinary, I'm learning from Michael Gelb in his book, Brain Power, that when we force the brain to learn something new, and all the brain fitness experts are suggesting this, learn to speak a foreign language, learn to play a musical instrument, learn to juggle. Those things require not only new neurons, but new connections among the neurons, so we keep an integrated brain functioning. Exercise is one of the best things you can do for your brain, and it's not just the oxygen which we need, and it's not just the endorphins that make you feel good. But when we exercise, we're putting a slight stress on the brain, and it forces it to release what's called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF, and that makes the brain grow new nerve cells. So when we exercise, we're making the brain grow. There was an article in the New York Times in December, I believe, running makes your brain smarter, because it's true. So there are things that we can do as we age that will actually keep our brain kind of supple and functioning well. Healthy relationships, learning something new, and physical exercise.
Great. Let's take another live questioner.
Okay.
And we have someone who is completely anonymous. We can't tell who you are. There's a couple of you, actually, but one of you is now mic'd, so please speak. Hello?
Hi, thank you. Thank you both so much for this timely and highly valuable conversation. And Linda, I will definitely look further into your work.
Great.
In the field of neuroscience and in your own work, how much attention is being given to the growing scientific research showing the harmful neurological effects of the escalating amount of man-made EMF and RF radiations coming from the things like cell phones and cordless phones, the Wi-Fi devices and computers, all those things that we're now surrounded with?
You know, there is more and more research, not only about the immediate physical costs of radiation coming from these devices, but in fact, the social costs of the minerals that we use in manufacturing these devices that cause civil war in countries all over the world. So it's an excellent question. I think part of the difficulty is simply getting the word out to people, and sometimes that happens on people's websites or blogs. The Greater Good Science Center out of UC Berkeley is something that posts information about that kind of research a lot. And so by asking for information about that, we're more likely to generate the research. Unfortunately, research dollars tend to follow big money. And so when people are making big money off of cell phones and iPhones and all those devices, they're not necessarily going to fund the research that shows the harmful effects, and it might be more difficult to get the funding dollars that would reveal that research. But it's by asking questions and insisting that people look for answers that we might be able to make a change about that. There are so many things that can be harmful to the brain, and some of them are our favorite things, like caffeine or alcohol or pot, or being addicted to stress, you know, not being able to slow down and let go and get a good night's sleep. So while we're trying to pay attention to all the things that can be harmful to the brain, I'm also suggesting that we pay attention to the things that can be helpful to the brain, and just try to let go of the unwholesome and cultivate the wholesome. Anger is harmful to the brain. Laughter is helpful to the brain. So the more we know about those things, the more we can try to let go of one and cultivate the other.
You know, I'm tempted to speak up here. I had a 10-year career in which I learned a lot about these things back. I was kind of sounding the alarm about them back before it was fashionable to do so. Mm-hmm. And you know what I've learned about it is one of the key principles is the idea of total load. That is, we are being stressed in all kinds of ways by all kinds of things, and it's the total load of stressors that are the biggest issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that there was a tendency among even myself and certainly most of the people who were focusing on the problems of the RFs and the EMFs, to be, you know, we were a pretty sensitive crowd, you know. People, like, I can sense a cell phone. If they feel, like, kind of tingly hot to me, you know. Mm-hmm. I sense that RF. It's very palpable. And when you've got a sensitive system, you can, you know, sensitivity is kind of cuts two ways. It's a really good thing to be more aware, and it's a bad thing to be more susceptible.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to come to a way of relating to these things that would minimize them. Like, I would make sure that I didn't get clothes dry cleaned at a place that used chemicals and then bring them home in a plastic bag and unveil them in my room where I was sleeping, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Things that don't exaggerate my load. But I also, you know, and I would, you know, I always use a headset with my cell phone, for instance. I never put it next to my head. You know, a variety of just coping skills. The other thing is an attitude that just is an attitude of resilience altogether, because when I'm concentrating on all the ways these things can hurt me, I'm tending to be getting into frames of mind that are less resilient in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something of a both and to appreciating the reality of these dynamics and relating to them in a yes, I can kind of a way, rather than an, oh my gosh, it's going to overwhelm me kind of way. And that's almost the most important thing of all when I consider these things with folks.
I agree. And if I could, I'd like to segue in a different direction from that caller's question. Shirley Turkle at MIT has been researching the impact of social media, email and cell phones, on human relationships for the last 25 years. And in that sense, the news is not good, that people are actually developing less relational skills and less relational intelligence when we become more dependent on social media. And that's not to say that cell phones and Facebook and email, they all have their place. In many ways, they can improve communication, the ease of communication all around the world. But in terms of direct heart-to-heart, soul-to-soul kind of communication, it's having a negative impact. And one of the examples that Shirley gave was mothers now often will be on their cell phone while they're nursing, and they might get some bad news from a friend, and they go, ah! And the baby has absolutely no way of knowing what just happened. As far as they know, something dangerous might have happened to their mother, something dangerous might be happening to them. And it's a kind of impact of social media that we're not always completely aware of. Holding that in the perspective that, yes, these tools often allow us to connect with people in ways that otherwise would not be possible. So then I'm going back to what you said, Terry, about an attitude of resilience and being able to keep a larger perspective, make our own conscious choices about how we want to use these devices and what impact they're going to have on our lives, and in that way try to respond to this changing social situation in a way that's resilient and flexible.
Yeah, beautiful. That's that is actually something that we encounter even more frequently.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you. Did you want to say anything more before we move on?
Mm-mm.
Okay. Thank you for your question. And let's take another live question. I like hearing people's voices. I'm not sure whether this is a first or a last name. In Acton, Massachusetts, Mangone or Menjone?
Ah, okay. Yep, this is actually Joe Caratenuto.
Oh, hello, Joe.
Hi, that's a previous cell phone owner.
I see.
And my question, I guess, was led into by the earlier question from British Columbia. And you mentioned being with people who know joy,
mm-hmm.
right, to boost yourself. How about the other way around? If you're the one feeling the joy and the people around you are not, is there a way to help the others around you who are, you know, maybe down in the mouth? to feel
right,
it without being in their face. And
so you're addressing emotional contagion, which is a very real reality in the human species, that we are hardwired to pick up the emotional states of other people unconsciously, does not have to go through conscious processing. It certainly does not need words. And so that's how we can pick up the anger of somebody else or the grief of somebody else or the joy of somebody else. We're hardwired for that. So it's a basic part of human communication. In terms of being resilient, if your own experience, oh, this is really going to lead into a bigger topic. If your own experience is stronger and steadier, then yes, you can influence the people around you. And the example that's often given is from Thich Nhat Hanh when he was talking about the Vietnamese boat refugee people, and if people were scared, if there was one person on the boat that could stay calm, the entire boat could stay calm. But that means having that particular, your joy, for instance, stronger and steadier. Now, what this leads me into is a mechanism of rewiring the brain that the neuroscientists have seen in their scanners only in the last 5 to 7 years. And they call it deconsolidation, reconsolidation. In the book, I call it reconditioning. And what it simply is when we can pair a positive memory, a positive experience, with a negative, more problematic one. And if we can hold them in our awareness at the same time, so that all the neurons that constellate the negative memory are firing, and all the neurons that constellate the positive memory are firing, and if we hold them in awareness at the same time, those neurons will fall apart and rewire together. It is possible for the positive to trump and rewire the negative. That's the basis of all trauma therapy. So whether we're doing that within our own brain or we're doing it in a group of people, when the positive is steadier and stronger, it can rewire the negative. So you can influence the moods of people around you, especially if they're open to being influenced. But that is somewhat encouraging, to think that we don't necessarily have to be pulled into the vortex of other people's emotions. We can hold our own and even influence them.
Are there particular behaviors or particular things that help the more positive states of mind prevail?
Well, there's a couple of things. It helps to have what technically is called theory of mind. It's an understanding that your experience over there could be very different than my experience over here. In other words, there's a differentiation. And we need to have that differentiation so that we don't just automatically pick up somebody else's anger and become angry ourselves, or pick up somebody else's depression and become depressed ourselves. So that meta-mentalizing, you can have your experience and it doesn't have to be the same as mine, is supposed to develop by the time we're 4 years of age. And that doesn't necessarily develop for everyone by the time they're four. So a key factor in recovering our resilience is to be able to recover that capacity for theory of mind and differentiation. In other words, not taking somebody else's experience personally as though it's our own. The other thing that can help the positive prevail is a practice, this is from our friend Rick Hansen, of taking in the good. Because the brain is hardwired to notice negative and intense experiences more than positive and subtle experiences, and that's for survival reasons, we have to intentionally, consciously cultivate a sense of the positive and then take it in. We have to notice it, feel it in our body, focus on it for 30 seconds so the brain has a chance to install it in long-term memory. So when we have an ongoing practice of noticing the good, noticing the good, noticing the good, then when something negative comes along, we're much more likely to have the positive as a resource that is already strong enough to hold its own, let alone rewire the negative.
Is that helpful, Joe?
Very much, yes. Thank you.
Great. Good to hear your voice, Joe.
Good to hear.
Okay. We have another question that was typed in that I want to make sure to ask, which is about trauma. Ross Jones asks about repeated early life trauma, complex trauma, and, you know, what are the special implications of what you've learned about resiliency for people who have that residue and legacy in their nervous systems?
Right. Well, trauma is one of the things that I've specialized in my own clinical practice. So in the book, I do distinguish between an external stressor and then our internal response to it, which is the stress response. So very often people say that they're stressed out because of these external factors. The stress is the internal response to those factors. Trauma, by definition, is an event that overwhelms our coping mechanisms, at least temporarily. When trauma happens, then very often the memory and the response to that experience is compartmentalized in a trauma pocket in our brain so that it doesn't have to interfere with the rest of our functioning. But it's always kind of there and can go off like a landmine to trip up our resilience. So trauma can definitely derail resilience. The earlier the trauma, the more impact it will have on the developing brain. It can even derail the development of the hippocampus, because that's where new cells are being formed all the time, and that can impact our memory, and it can impact our capacity to learn from experience in a new way. So in dealing with trauma, there has to be a container of both awareness and acceptance. There's mindfulness and compassion. This is what happened. This was the impact on me. This is what I did. This is what the cost was. This is what I would do differently now. This is what I've learned, so that we can begin to develop a sense of resilience going forward. But also, as I said earlier, that reconditioning mechanism is the basis of all trauma therapy. When we can remember a small, chunkable size of the trauma, not the whole thing, the point is never to be re-traumatized, but we call into consciousness a moment of the trauma held in a larger awareness and compassion, so that we can fully experience that moment of trauma, but not be hijacked by it, and not repeat and dig the grooves in our neural circuitry any deeper. We're using the mindfulness and the compassion to actually begin to rewire our relationship to that moment. Trauma therapy doesn't rewrite history, but it does rewire the brain. And it doesn't change what happened, but it changes our relationship to what happened. So neuroscience has been of tremendous help to people in trauma work, because as we understand how trauma impacts the brain and how to reverse that, there's actually great hope that people can recover from previous trauma. And the experience, I mean, I've done EMDR therapy for 18 years now, and the experience often is we're pairing the positive with the negative, the processing is going on in the brain, and what happens over time, which could be in a session or three sessions, the person says, huh, what was I so upset about? Because the wiring has actually changed in the brain. It just doesn't carry the same charge that it did before. So it's very exciting what's happening in trauma therapy now, but it really depends on this container of being mindful and being compassionate. That's how the brain can be plastic and rewire.
Beautiful. Well, thank you, Linda. This has been really, really rich. I want to tell people about what's coming up next week, and thank you, and just say goodbye. Just a few reminders. Linda's website is lindagram-mft.net. If you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it, and they can register at beyondawakeningseries.com. You're also invited to go to terrypattoncourse.com to look at my course, or terrypatton.com to sign up for my newsletter or to inquire about working with me personally and even taking the course with personal guidance. Now, in just 3 weeks from yesterday, on Sunday, July 7th at 10 a.m. Pacific, I'm going to be speaking with Terrence Deacon, a neuroscientist who is also the head of the anthropology department at UC Berkeley. His latest book is Incomplete Nature, How Mind Emerged from Matter. Almost everyone we've talked with on this series sees consciousness as fundamental, as the foundation of reality. In that sense, we're what's called panpsychist in philosophical terms, which means we really think that consciousness goes all the way down to matter, even below the biological level. And we think that mechanistic explanations of our inner lives are laughably incomplete. But Professor Deacon is a scientist who has looked from a so-called mechanistic point of view in a much more nuanced way, factoring in pattern, looking at the dynamics of whirlpools and vortices and other self-organizing systems in a way that has really raised the level of my understanding of the relationship of consciousness and matter. And I think it's going to be a very rich education. So I'm actually going to be extending my show for an extra half an hour, just because his ideas are so complex it'll take that long to really get this education forward. But I think it's going to be a really valuable session. So I have reserved that time, and I think we're going to have a really dynamic conversation. This is Sunday, July 7th at our regular time, 10 a.m. Pacific. Linda, thank you so much for spending this time with me and with all the listeners today.
You're very welcome.
It's been a real pleasure.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Okay, everybody. Goodbye.